Okay, so I'm Dove, I'm a sexaholic. Thanks for that last minute announcement, whoever you were. And so I think I introduced myself already. I'm Dove, I'm a sexaholic, and I'm powerless over lust. I'm actually more powerless over lust now than I was before I started recovery. And I love saying that. And guys have told me they hate when I say that. I'm not talking about, I'm defining my powerlessness over lust in a very clear fashion. And we talked about this on the last call a little bit. Powerless over lust does not mean like, you know, for a guy who's just starting recovery, for an alcoholic or a sexaholic who's just starting recovery, powerless over lust means that I'm guaranteed to drink again. Guaranteed to drink again every single time the opportunity arises. I'm a goner. You know, if I'm alone with a computer, and there's unfiltered internet, or there is filtered internet because I know how to get around it, I'm going to act out. If my wife is Materis, I'm going to drive her crazy with sex stuff. If there's a girl in the office who's pretty, that's it, I'm finished. You know, because I'm a sexaholic, and look, the book says, it's a religion. It says I am powerless over lust, so I must believe that. I must agree to that, you know, as though it's some kind of a religion. And I tried to emphasize when we talked about the first step that this, the 12 steps, Yiddishkeit is a religion. It's dogma. It's a religion. 12 steps is not. You know, and the more we make it into dogma, which some people do, the more distasteful it gets for new people that come in, because the humility is lost, the sharing is gone, and it's dogma. Oh, it's dogma. That's all it is. And Orthodox Jews love that. We love dogma, you know. And at the same time, we hate it, because we hate often, many of us hate our Yiddishkeit. We just don't know it yet, or we don't show it. But, you know, especially guys who are brought up in a restrictive kind of way, and they have to do this and they have to do that, and part of them just goes crazy whenever they act out. They wonder, like, I feel so alive. I feel so excited. I feel so this. Why? It's very simple. Because they're always holding themselves back. Always. You know, and then when they're perek whole completely, it's a feeling they never experienced, and they think they like it because it's so unique. It's so different. It's refreshing, you know. And it's very, very scary. Because especially if they already have a life, you know, a marriage, a family, a community, and a religion, you know. And they're thinking like, Gevalt, Rabboni Shalom, where do you fit into all this? What's going on? Everything's up for grabs. And that often happens in early recovery, and it's a very, very upsetting and confusing time. If it's not confronted and worked through, then recovery won't happen, you know. The person's got to be honest with themselves and work through these things, and you know, with their steps and friends in the program and, you know, sponsor. But, I mean, these things can't be ignored and brushed under the rug, obviously. But anyway, so the guy, you know, approaches the program and he says, oh, I'm powerless over lust. You know, I've heard people actually say, you have to convince yourself that you're powerless. You have to finally work on yourself until you admit that you're powerless. To me, it's, you know, it's pretty easy. I know I'm powerless. I when I don't do this program, I act out. You know, that's all. You know, so I'm sober because I'm working this program. I know that. So I know I'm powerless. But powerless doesn't mean powerless that I'm guaranteed to always be drinking. It means to me, one, eventually, if I don't work this step, if I manage my own life, I'm guaranteed to eventually drink again. Eventually. But powerless over lust, meaning like whenever a woman goes by, I'm powerless, I have to follow her. I'm powerless, I have to masturbate. I'm powerless, I have to have sex whenever it's around. That's not what powerless means. What powerless means is that when I lust, I cannot control it like a normal person can control it. A normal person can enjoy, you know, you think that every, now I'm sure people here would say, yeah, I do think exactly that. You think that everybody who watches an R-rated movie, all the R-rated movies in the United States have nudity in them, you think everybody who watches them, they're all sexaholics? They're all going home and masturbating, you know? They're all, they're all addicts. All the people who drink alcohol are, you know, or who get drunk sometimes, they're all alcoholics. It's crazy. The pornography industry is mainly supported by normal non-sexaholic people, for sure. Just normal people who have desires and enjoy this crap, you know, and that's who the bulk of the porn industry is supported by, probably. You know, I'm talking about Playboy, all these magazines. You know, there really are mostly entertainment, you know, entertainment. For you, for me, if you're a sexaholic like I am, this stuff is not entertainment. No more than alcohol, beer, wine, liquor is entertainment for an alcoholic. Try to ask an alcoholic who's an active alcoholic, try to ask him if he feels like wine and beer and alcohol is that's how, you know, why does he drink it? For entertainment, you know? You know, he knows that that's not the truth. He knows that for him, it's like, this is way more important than entertainment. This is like, this is the only thing he's got. You know, this is the most important thing he's got. He can't live without it, you know? I mean, you know, everybody knows that if you took away television from your average American, he wouldn't, like, go out of his mind. He'd get busy with others. He'd be angry at you, but he'd get busy with other stuff, and he'd be okay. You know, an alcoholic, you take away alcohol, he's going to rip your throat out, you know? Same thing over here, you know? So this is too important. You know, when I was talking with a guy this morning, we were talking about marriage, and Yitzchak brought this up just before the call started today, and I thank him. He brought up sex and marriage. You know, lust in marriage, sex in marriage, it's a big topic, and it's beyond the scope of the step discussion, but I'd be glad to do a unit on that where I can basically not teach anything but just share. You know, and other people can share their experience, of course, as well, you know. But sex and marriage, lust and marriage. You know that marriage, sex doesn't have to be lust. You know, how do I know? Because if I look at a news story, you know, about some schmutzy topic, and I'm curious, you know, oh, so-and-so, sexual whatever, arrested for this, da-da-da, scandal, da-da-da, with the girls in here, and again, da-da-da-da, and I read the story, I feel inside, whoa, Dove, you're getting interested in this story. This is something that I want to hide and make sure no one's watching me see it and sneak it and hop it and this. And I feel inside, you know, and then there'll be pictures of an actress involved in a scandal, and it makes me meshuggah. I know I can't watch that kind of stuff. I know I can't read that article. I know I can't. Because even if I just read it, I feel the excitement, the sexual excitement inside, you know. And it's stealing, and I feel like I'm just gonna, you know, I mean, I could even be so sensitive that, and I am at this point in recovery, that I can't tolerate lust. If I actually do that, read this kind of stuff, without touching myself or anything, you know, I'm gonna, ejaculate. I mean, it's over, you know, without even getting an erection, you know, because. I have a sensitivity. My threshold has gotten much, much lower in recovery to lust. But on the other hand, I can function perfectly normal with my wife, and enjoy ourselves, you know, on a good day. Why is that? How is that possible? Because I'm not stealing anything. I'm not sneaking anything. It's not lust. You know, the other issue is when sex becomes a requirement in marriage and it starts to, and there's lust in it, You know it because of one thing. And this is something that I struggle with, and I know many people do. You know that there's some lust in there because, why? Because it's serious. For sexaholics, sex and marriage gets ruined because it gets too important, it gets too serious, and it's not fun. And you know, the Zohar Kodesh, I was shocked. I read the Zohar Kodesh says that I don't know if people here are initiated or not, this kind of thing. But I mean, but just from the little bit that I exposed myself to in that area of Torah, you know, there it says Zerantin is the Makor HaSimcha for Nukveh, you know, which is a model for husband and wife in some way, that the husband is the Makor HaSimcha for his wife. Whoa! In other words, sex is supposed to be fun, too. Living together in general is supposed to be fun, you know? Wow. If it's not fun, I'm not even interested, you know? I mean, I know I am, because I still have lust, of course. And, you know, thank God I'm a work in progress, you know? But I know that, you know, I'm powerless over lust, you know? When I follow the lust, it takes me way past where I choose to go, because I cannot control it. You know, and I talked about this the last time, that Frum Yidden can sin, as the Rambam and the Torah says many times, you can sin. Hashem lets us sin. He doesn't make it impossible for us to sin. In other words, He allows us to sin. But it's a sin. It's wrong, you know? And there is consequences for everything that I do. If I look at a woman going from the bus and I, like, take her image in, if I see, the first look is on God, second look is on me. That's an important rule because it's the truth. That's why the Isser isn't Re'iyas Nashim, it's Histaklus, which means looking into it. Hatsoifa Benashim, you know, Yoresh Gehenim. And I say that to myself, you know, when I have someone passes by and, you know, somewhere and I see it's a woman, and it seemed at first glance, my radar went up, it seemed like a nice figure, and I want to see, let me check again, let me see what's puts up there. My body wants to check again, you know, I'm curious, which means my body wants to check again. And then I realize, you know, that's Hatsoifa Benashim. That means that I'm choosing to check her out. There's no tachlis for me to check her out except for one tachlis, to fire up my imagination. That's the only tachlis. And she's not mine. And I remember for my first couple years in recovery, I remember going through the supermarket, and, you know, there's a lot of women there, and here I am supposed to be shopping, you know. And there's a lot, some of them are pretty, I'm sure. You know, I can examine them, you know. I know, if you're a sexaholic, you know. If you go to a business educational, you know, seminar or something like that, by the time lunch hits, you know, by the time 3 hours is done, if you're a sexaholic in recovery, you know, not in recovery especially, you know, you've picked out who the prettiest woman in the crowd is by now, by the time lunch is. You've already picked it out, you know, because you get there late, so you're sitting in the back of the room anyway, and you see all the heads in front of you, and you're picking, you know, it's a beauty pageant, you know, it's a beauty pageant. So this is my natural state as a sexaholic, you know what I mean? And it's not subtle, it's not like people think, oh, yeah, you're a sexaholic, it takes over your whole life, that's not like me. For you, it's like a constant obsession, constant, that's all you do all day long, that's all you think about all day long, and this, and then you go home and you have to masturbate yourself five times, and that's generalities. I'm talking about, it's way too important to me, you know? And I notice that, that's all. And it's a beauty pageant, going to a thing, if I'm picking out who the prettiest girl in the crowd is, if I figured it out by lunch, by accident, you know? That's weird. Something's wrong, you know? Normal people don't do that. Normal people notice a pretty woman. Nothing wrong with that. But, you know, noticing it and discovering it, you know, that's something's wrong. So I'll have, you know, this kind of thing be going on, you know? And I remember going, in my first couple of years in recovery, I remember frequently going to the supermarket or places and then noticing a pretty woman, and saying to myself, when I felt like, let me check her out now, I saw, oh, she looks at it, that it's, this is a matter of 2 seconds. You know, passing by and then checking out. There's no 3-second rule. It's crazy. It's a matter of like an intentional check, you know, and saying to myself, she's not yours. She's not mine. Not yours. She's not mine. You know, and I remember that was like a mantra of mine when I would see the thing, that's not mine, she's not mine, this thing isn't mine, that's not mine. You know, because my radar was up and I was noticing a lot of these things. So I'm lusting, you know, by doing that, you know. But I'm dealing with it in a recovery sort of a way. Nothing to cry about. Slowly, as I give up the opportunities, as I'm giving up the opportunities, one after another, that's called surrendering the opportunities, one after another, and, you know, I'm letting go of the lust, you know, slowly, letting go of the lust, you know. So this kind of a thing, those are exercises, and that's things that a person can do so that they let go of their lust, you know. The lust itself reduces because they're taking acts of surrender, you know. Nida.
Those?
Yeah.
It's actually, I thought I was the guy that invented the phrase, she's not mine. I didn't know anyone else used it.
Yeah. There was a time where it was very important to me, and I use it occasionally now, too. So it's a big one. This is not my chelek. In other words, for a religious guy to say she's not mine, to him that might be a tremendous problem, because damn it, she's not mine. That's what he really means. She's not mine. It's usher for me to look at her. That's what he means. Oy, shakes de shakzenu, it's usher for me to look at her. Givald, she's not mine. Chalila, this. All that's going to do is make him act out, for sure. For sure. It's going to drive him crazy. He's just, it's like he's teasing. You say, that's another tease. That's another tease. That's another tease. That's all he's doing, counting the teases, you know. What I hope I'm doing when I do this is I'm letting it go, and I'm saying, well, she's not mine. That's just the truth.
Right. Can I say something here that I think might be useful?
Please. Anybody
okay.
can.
I don't know if anyone else. I don't think I read this. Whatever. There are two approaches to life in this very simplified philosophy. One is a groan, one is a sigh. A groan is a complaint, a gripe, a resentment, you know. In this case, she's not mine. I sure wish she would. She looks better than my wife. And I could use two wives, or three wives, or I could use 100 wives, you know. And life isn't fair. And that'll lead me to act out. That's a groan. That's a complaint. A sigh is like a surrender. Like, you know, I sigh. God, I can't handle this. I need you to do it for me, you know. I recognize I've got a real high sensitivity here. I've got an allergy. I don't want to activate my allergy and take in the lust and activate it. I have the allergy, but I don't need to activate it. I need your help, God. That's a sigh. And it's the same sight. It's just, am I going to groan that I can't have it, or I'm going to sigh that I can't handle it and ask God to help me? Right.
So if it's not mine, then I can surrender it. And that is called letting go of lust. How do you know if you're letting go? How do I know if I'm letting go of lust? There's only one way. How do I know if I'm surrendering lust? How do I know if I'm letting go of the lust? There's only one way to know. And it's obvious and everybody knows it. It's not if I forego the opportunity to lust. That is good. It's an exercise toward surrendering lust. But it's not surrendering lust. Surrendering lust means that I let it go. How do I know if I let it go? There's only one way. I have peace and quiet in my gut. I'm okay. I'm okay with it. I'm at peace with it. I can be happy without it. I'm okay without it. I'm okay as I am, you know? I'm okay with what I have, you know? I'm okay with reality. That's why the third step is so essential. That's why the third step is the crux of everything in recovery. And steps, it's like the first three steps are like pointing toward step three. It's like they're descending, it's like they're going up towards step three. They're They're working towards a step three. One, I certainly can't manage my own life. Step two, who in the heck can manage my own life? A power greater than myself can, because I can't. Well, let me find one. Let me find a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. That's what I need. I don't need sobriety. Sobriety, of course I need. That goes without saying. What I really need is sanity, because I'm a shiganer. I'm unhappy and I'm a shiganer. I can't manage my own life, and I'm guaranteed to keep acting out because, you know, if, even though I'm sober now, I'm guaranteed to return to acting out because I'm deficient. I'm powerless over lust. And when things get bad enough and life sucks, I'm going to use my drug again. I know it. I know I will. I'm going to use my drug again because I'm going to have so much pain that I'm going to need to medicate myself, you know? You know? But now, women walking by doesn't make me need to medicate myself necessarily. You know what I'm saying? A fantasy going through my head doesn't make me need to medicate myself, but real life will. Real life will hurt, and it will make me need to medicate myself. So I'm going to need somebody to manage my life in a successful way so that I can, for a change, have peace. I need a basic spiritual rest, as Chuck C. calls it. You know, menucha. Ze yenachameinu mimaisa yadeinu mi'itzavoneinu. Noach. And does anyone know what the Zohar, people here know? The Zohar says, Noach dos Shabbos. Noach, he is Shabbos. That is Shabbos, Noach. That's why the halachas, by the way, of Erev, Tumin, are learned from Noach. And something else is learned from Noach, I forget what. The Zohar Kodesh points it out. But the Tzror HaMor, if you have that sefer, Tzror HaMor on Parshas Noach, he has a gorgeous piece on Noach about Hilchos Shabbos learned from Noach. It's just gorgeous if you have a chance to look at it. But anyhow, but because Noach, Shabbos is Menucha. On Shabbos, what are you? You're dead. You know, you go to the mikveh, you wear levanim, you know, Anatomy of a Search, that guy, whatever his name is. He writes that what's the pshat? You go to the mikveh before Shabbos. You know, it's a tahara. You wear white, al pi kabbalah. You're supposed to wear white on Shabbos. You know, it's because it's tachrichin. You know, what are you doing? Oineg, 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 oineg. There's no mitzvah of oineg in Yiddishkeit except on Shabbos. What's with the tainug, sex and food and sleep and this? Because it's olam haba. You're play acting olam haba. That's what Yiddishkeit is all about, play acting. Chayavad and Lahara says Atzmo, you know, and different holidays on Sukkot. We live in a Sukkot. We're play acting the experience of the Jews had in Sukkot, you know, by living in a Sukkot. Shabbos, you're play acting Olam Haba. In other words, you're dead. You know, life is over. Ki'ilu kol malachtecha asuya. That's Pshat. Rashi says, right? Vaychal, you know, a person finishes in malachtecha. Ki'ilu kol malachtecha asuya. That's Shavas. In other words, you can't do anymore. There's no more mitzvahs in the kever. You're dead. There's nothing to do. There's no tikkunim on Shabbos. There's no birurim on Shabbos, the B'nai Sosper, right? There's no avodas of birur of mitzvotas on Shabbos at all. You know? That's why you can't do malacha, he says, because you're dead. So, in other words, it's all done. There's peace, you know? You are what you are, and there's acceptance of it and stuff. This is it. You know, that's like, wow, menucha, that's what step three is. That's what step three is. It's a basic spiritual rest. I can't keep hold of that, though, because I have character defects. And because I've hurt other people. And because I live a screwed up life based on all the damage that I caused in my acting out. A guy was telling me last night that he's, you know, everything's fine. His marriage is fine. His this is fine. His that is fine. It's just that he's going to prostitutes once in a while. You know, a ton of chacham. You know, once or twice a year, he's going to prostitutes. But he has a great marriage in every respect. But he has this problem. And I'm like, what great marriage? It's based on a lie. You know, and then the other issue is, what about the money that you spent on these women? You know? What about the money? Where did the money come from? How did you launder it? How did you hide it? There's got to be a web of lies over here, you know? So, but we don't see that, you know, unless we want to, you know? So, I mean, the life that we live as addicts makes it impossible for us to really give our lives over to a power greater than ourselves or God as we understand him. You know, and then you have the problem that all firm guys have, which is, guard your eyes, of course, you know, being a religious website, of course, no one talks about finding a power greater than yourselves. They talk about finding Hashem. What finding a power greater than yourself? Hashem, we already have him. Oh, I was talking to a guy, non-Jewish guy, happened to be married to a shiksa, at an SA meeting. He wants me to sponsor him. We're taking a walk and discussing, you know, program and whether I could sponsor him and stuff. And we're walking around, this is about 10 years ago, walking around in the parking lot after the meeting. He's telling me how he lost two or three jobs in the military already because of looking at porn. And I said to him, okay, this and this and that, and that, and that. And the steps, we talked a bit about the steps, and I talked about finding God, you know, which is what the steps are really all about, finding God, finding your own God, finding God. And he says to me, oh, I'm very religious, I have that already, I'm a Christian, and I go to church, you know, every morning, and, you know, so I have a God, so that's done. What's the next step about? Okay? So now, even a guard your eyes guy who's about, you know, who says, of course, this God is Hashem, of course, you know, would say to this guy, because he's a guy after all, would say to him, oh, you obviously don't have a God yet, because, which is what I said to him, you obviously don't have a God yet, because if you did, why are you jerking off all the time? Why are you losing your job all the time? Why are you doing this? Why are you resorting to trying to manage your own life if you really believe that you really have a God? You don't have a God. You're just religious. You don't have a God. You know, you can be religious without having a God, obviously. So, and many of us are. You know, but what about us? Oh, when it comes to us, though, since we, you know, he's got Jesus or something. When it comes to us, oh, we of course have Hashem. The question is, how do you find Hashem? I'm sorry, that's not what the steps are about. The steps aren't about which God you have. The steps are about the God of the, as Chuck says, the God of your understanding. How do you understand? What's your relationship with your own God? I don't care what you call him. The steps don't care what you call him. Call him Hashem until your face is blue. It doesn't matter. You may believe that he's a jerk. Okay? Then your relationship with him is not exactly going to work very well. You may believe that, well, he's a melech usser bar hatim. He has to punish me because he made in the Torah these rules, and therefore he's going to kill my children and kill me before 50 because I masturbated, or I'm going to die in a this or a that, drown and strangling, chenek for Arias, blah, 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 blah. Do you think your God likes you or not? Well, of course I do, but we have to believe in Tzchar V'Einish, so what am I going to do? You know, are you saying that God has no schar v'onesh? Chas v'shalom. You know, of course I don't believe that, you know, God has no schar v'onesh. That's good. You know, I don't believe that. But I don't understand schar v'onesh the way that you do. You know, I don't believe God can be mean to me. Like I said at the beginning of the third step talk, I don't think that he's able, kaviyochel, to be mean to anyone or bad to anyone or hurt anyone. He can only, kaviyachol, only do chesed. He's only good. All the dinim and all the stuff is just, it's just the chitzaynias of the stuff. It's just the chitzaynias, and that's why they call it ra. What does Chazal say? The pasuk says in Yeshaya, Yotzer or avorei choshech, oseh shalom uvorei ra. That's the pasuk. In Shachris, what do we say? Yotzer or avorei choshech, oseh shalom uvorei es hakol. We don't say Ra. We say Uvareyas Hakol. So, you know, what does it say in Bereshis? It says, he saw the man and everything he created, Vihine Tov Na'od. Tov is Tov. And Ma'od, that's Ra, that's Mavis, that's Ra. You know? What's going on over here? That's the Yetzer Hara and Ra and stuff. Whoa, Tov Ma'od, it makes it even better? Yeah. Because he has a plan. And the Ra is really just the chitonius of something that's really Tov, and he's in control. There's no such thing as God's not in control. Rabbi Nachman, the poster rabbi for all the, you know, masturbators in the universe who are from, he says, you know, there's no such thing as Yish. That's his whole thing. His whole Torah is built on this thing. There's no such thing as a place where their God is not. That's the big song in Israel now. In right, the Hester, Hanochi Aster, Ahaster, Aster, Panai, that even in the Hester of the Hester, that you don't even know there's a Hester, as the Baal Shem Tov says, Hashem is there too, you know? Or like David HaMelech says, like I said many times already, you know, in Atzia Sha'ol Hineka, what does it say? In Esak Shamayim Shamata, Atzia Sha'ol Hineka, there's no place, Leisasar Panoi Minei Klal, you know? So, Leisasar Panoi Minei, so, you know, this is basic stuff. Sarva Onesh, I have to have a different understanding of what God's purpose is in all the Sarva Onesh stuff. Why in the heck is that good? I can't understand it. I don't like it. I hate pain. I broke my leg once. I hate that pain. You stub your toe. The pain is horrible. I just, how can God be good? Our heart is telling us he's a jerk. Our heart is telling us he doesn't care. He cares about himself and his own big fat agenda. And we have to be good. I want to have a good time here. The fact that I have to twist myself to his agenda makes me upset. That's the problem we have. If we say, oh no, that doesn't bother me at all. That's for women and children, like the Rambam says. You know, yours are onesh. Oh, that's for kids, for uneducated people, you know. Me, I understand these things. I read Mr. Milieu, I read Tanya. You know, I know all this stuff. You know, it's no problem. You know, don't believe it. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. These things have to be worked through, you know. Not for everybody. For some people, yeah. But just because he says so, I don't believe it. Let's see. You know, we'll go through. You know, we'll talk. Let's see. You know, over time, when the self-honesty comes, because the masturbation and the lusting and everything comes to the outside, then the self-honesty will come in a religion and in everything else and in my marriage and in my children. It took me 2, 3, 4 years of sober in recovery to admit that I had feelings of hatred for my own child. Imagine how painful it is for me, for a father, to admit publicly in front of his recovery friends that he feels like he hates his son. You know? But it was the truth, you know? Oh, what good did you get out of it? Well, look, you know, a lot of people think that acting out therapy is a great thing. I heard Rav Twersky once, maybe he changed his mind, just like he changed his mind about sex addiction, because in the beginning, Rav Twersky didn't believe in sex addiction at all, as far as I'm aware. But now he does. I heard him say that stuff, acting out things, taking a baseball bat, hitting the pillow that you write mom on, and you're screaming at it, you know, and you're smashing the pillow, it lets out frustrations and hatred to your mother. You know, Twersky doesn't, you know, he said, I heard him say once, like, all it's going to do is build it up, is strengthen, you know, the anger and stuff like that. Okay, I don't know. Maybe he didn't mean that exactly, but there's this machloikes between the therapists about that. But certainly, it's not that way when it comes to admitting feelings. You know, admitting feelings, It's just the truth, you know? I'm not taking my yarmulke off and throwing it. I'm still wearing my Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, you know, which I do by choice. And, you know, but this is, again, this is all of the path to step 3 in reverse. So the first 2 steps are leading us to step 3. And the next, oops, I'm not good at math. Let me count them. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. The next 7 steps are leading us backwards to the third step. They're just the, you know, the back route to the third, back to the third step. That's all they are, getting rid of the human ego and leading us back to step three, which means serenity, Shabbos. Shabbos, that's what it is, it's Shabbos. Recovery, serenity from recovery is Shabbos to me. You know, Kol Melach Ha'asuya, I'm in God's hands, there ain't nothing I can do. Everything's okay, you know? And you know, that's it. That's, you know, recovery is supposed to lead a person eventually to, they call it happy, joyous, and free. Sefer Mishlei calls it Lev Chacham Mishte Tamid. You know? Lev Chacham Mishte Tamid. Wise person, in his heart, it's a constant party. You know, I know a guy who davens every day. He says, God, he's a really great Chassidish guy. He says, God, please, please, Tate, in Yiddish, I'm sure he says it, Tate, please, if you know that today I'm going to act out, kill me now. Take me now, right now. Take me now. If you know I'm going to act out today, please, Tate, take me now. You know? And he says it with his full heart, and he means it. And he doesn't cry over it with regret, and he's a martyr, nothing. It's just a simple acceptance. I'm not, if you know I'm going to act out today, take me now, you know. And another guy I know, he said to me, also a youth, he said to me that every day, if he ever feels upset, he remembers that he's sober, and he feels like he wants to dance. He says, everybody, if you're sober today, you should want to dance, you know, dance a little bit. You know, and sometimes I do. Once I was maybe sober 3 years, two, three years. So precious. Early sobriety, I lose the appreciation for it. You know, now because I'm jaded. But the early sobriety was so precious. It gave me so much more simcha, so much more naturally. Once I had my finger cut open, and I had to have stitches, and the doctor does the needle thing with the Novocaine, and there was a spot he just couldn't get. And I felt it completely. And he said, I'm sorry, the Novocaine is just not going to work on this spot. You're just going to feel me sewing through your skin. So he sewed, it was two stitches, that's all, thank God, in those parts, like six or seven altogether. But there were two stitches that I just felt everything completely, like just straight into the flesh and around the other side and back. And I have no pain tolerance whatsoever. I'm a good addict, and except for psychic pain. And I remember sitting there, closing my eyes real hard, and just smiling, thinking to myself, I'm sober. I'm 2.5, I'm 3 years sober. I can't believe it. I'm sober. I can't believe it. It's fantastic. I can't believe it. You know, I don't deserve this. I can't believe that I'm sober. This is fantastic. And I'm just thinking, feeling good about it. And my father-in-law was there with me, and he's like feeling sorry for me, and I'm doing fine, you know, I'm doing okay. And, you know, he didn't know what I was okay about. You know, nobody else knows. You know. Anyhow, third step. So 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 lead, all are like pointing back. It's like the menorah. You got the candles all pointing toward the middle, you know what I'm saying? The front ones in front forward, and the back, so the later ones on the way back. They're all pointing to the middle. Let me just stay with step four, okay? I talked a lot about lust because I know on this call there's a mixture. It's a mixed multitude. You've got a lot of guys who they're not even in recovery yet. They're still tachas yad masturbation and porn stuff, and they know that. But their concern is about sex in the marriage, that it should be right and this, and lust in the bedroom and this. They're not even ready for that yet, but that's all they're really interested in. You've got people who want to talk about Hashem and Yiddishkeit issues. Our clarity in Yiddishkeit, our belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu on a personal level, none of that stuff is going to become clear at all while we're still masturbating and looking at porn. You got to be sober for a while before you should even start worrying about that stuff, I think. And by the way, the steps are not made to get a person sober. The steps are made to keep a sober person sober. That's why. That's it. If you think you're going to succeed working step steps two, three, four, five, six, seven, while you're not sober yet, and you think that, oh, I'm not sober yet, but if I work through steps four and I work through my personal issues, then I'll be able to finally get sober. Good luck. Good luck. That's not the way the steps are designed, as far as I know. That's not the experience of alcoholics that I know. Alcoholics that I know say, good luck working a fourth step if you're not sober, because you're still so crazy you don't even realize it. You gotta get alcohol out of you first, and the compulsion and the obsession and the craziness for alcohol, you know, by surrendering it for a while before you're even going to have any hope of working a really true, honest fourth step. There's no harm in trying. I'm not saying don't try to work the steps, but you know, don't take it that seriously, because it ain't going to work. It ain't going to work that well, you know? It's not really designed to get a person sober. It's designed to help a person who knows that they have, who knows that they cannot drink, who accepts that they cannot drink. In other words, who has a first step, I cannot drink, period, because I can't control alcohol. I can't put it in my body, you know? I cannot act out sexually, because when I act out sexually, I cannot control it. Unlike everybody else who can just do tshuva. For me, tshuva doesn't work. It puts me in a pattern, and I just go back to the same kind of empty, dead shell of craziness that I was before. I can't go back to that lifestyle. You know, I'm not really a true, honest person. I can't go back to that. I can't afford it. I have a first step. My first step is why I cannot drink. I don't have the ability to drink. The first step is saying I cannot stop drinking of my own power, and I cannot continue drinking because I can't afford it, because my life is unmanageable. So what does that mean? That means I can't drink, but it's going to drive me crazy. Not drinking will drive me crazy, and drinking will drive me crazy. So what do? You obviously don't drink, and here come the steps. Step two, power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity, because if I drink, I'm crazy. If I don't drink, I'm crazy. I can't do either way, so I'm stuck. That's why we need step two, because we're sober, but we don't know how to stay sober. I need a higher power not to keep me sober. I need a higher power to get me sanity. That's what it is. And if I have the sanity, then of course sobriety is obvious. Sobriety is not going to be a problem, but sobriety, what do you think an alcoholic's real problem is, or a sexaholic's real problem is? People come and guard your eyes because they think their problem is the masturbation and the pornography. It's not. If they're regular, normal people, it is. Because for a normal, regular person, they're okay, but they have a yetzirah that's a problem. For an addict, the problem isn't the drinking and the masturbating, or the masturbating and the pornography. The problem is living without it is unacceptable. When he doesn't masturbate, he goes crazy. He goes out of his mind. He starts desiring it more and more and more until he just can't hold himself. I can't hold myself, you know? The problem that he's got is sobriety. That's his problem. He doesn't know how to deal with sobriety. Sobriety makes him miserable and meshuggah. Now, of course, his acting out makes him miserable and meshuggah too, but, you know, how meshuggah it really gets him, he doesn't see, because he's not sober yet. When you're sober, for a while, you start to see how crazy you really were before. You don't really see it when you're in it. You know, it seems to be the pattern. So those are like big, basic things to me, you know, that the drinking isn't the problem. The sobriety is the problem. We can't stand sobriety. That's the problem. That's why the steps are here. The steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, why is that there? 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, why are they there? Only one reason. Because I cannot stand sobriety, because I'm an addict. An addict can't stand sobriety. That's why he ends up drinking again. And I know Affirmy thinks that even if he's an addict, he thinks that the only reason he acts out again is because the temptation got too strong. And it's not true. It may happen once in a while that way, but in general, the reason that he ends up acting out again is because he can't stand living without it. Living without it is just impossible. He's too miserable with life. His wife is too ugly. His sex is too infrequent. His Talmidim don't listen, and he has no covet in school. The only time he really feels covet is when he's in his mind naked with the woman in the on the computer screen having sex with her. You know, that's the only time he really feels the covet he deserves, but he doesn't realize it because he's not sober. When he's sober, he'll start to realize, oh, that's what's going on, you know? I mean, stuff like that. Life just sucks. That's just the truth. Like the Ramchal says in the beginning of the Zilzi Sharm, he goes on a whole thing in the Hakdama about how life sucks. It does. You know? Okay, you want to get depressed, read that over and over and over. That's not his point. But his point is, you know, that life is limited, and that drives an alcoholic crazy or a sexaholic crazy. You know, so when you have a third step, yeah, life is limited, but life isn't about me. Life is really principally about God and his will. That's really what it's really, really about. And I'm working out his will right now. You know, a person who has a really good step three feels like a pipe, I'm told. You know, like a pipe. And God's will is going through me into the world. You know, for like a glass, like a window, you know, and the light's going through me. How does that happen? That's the Aspaklaria Hama'ira, right? Moshe Rabbeinu has Aspaklaria Hama'ira. Why did he have an Aspaklaria Hama'ira that the Nevuah went through him perfectly without any blemish whatsoever? Because he was the Anav Mikol Adam, because he didn't have an ego at all. His ego was so obliterated somehow that he didn't even have an ego. And if he doesn't have an ego, then he has an Aspaklaria Hama'ira. Me'ira doesn't mean bright. In Chazal's expression, bright glass means clear. Clear glass is called bright glass. You know, a clear lens is called an Aspaklaria Hama'ira. A darkened lens is Aspaklaria She'ena Me'ira means that it has blemishes in it and milkiness or whatever, so it's not clear glass. You know? So in other words, when you're anav, when you have anivus, God's will flows through you unblemished. That's what Aaron did. It says, Aaron, Kein asa Aaron. You know, as Hashem said him, Kein asa. Rashi says, exactly as Hashem commanded him. You know? So the Mefarshim asked, like, what does that mean? You know, like, what's the big thing of that? In other words, he didn't put in his own kavanas, his own myths. He just did it to do what Hashem's will was. That's it. He got himself out of the way. That's the key for a person who has third step. Now, if a person's acting out and he's working on his third step, he's making a huge mistake. You're not going to get sober by working on your third step any more than you will working on religion and Yiddishkeit. It's not going to get you sober if you're an addict. You get sober by working on your first step, working on acceptance that you cannot afford to drink. And it's a very upsetting, depressing, angering, frustrating, frightening thing for any alcoholic to recognize that he cannot drink anymore. It's terrifying. For us to recognize that we cannot live without pornography and masturbation is terrifying. But that's working on a first step. You don't get sober by working your fourth step either. You get sober by working your first step, admitting that I cannot drink. And just surrendering it, giving it up, because I can't have it, that's not mine. Other people can handle porn, and they're okay. They do tshuva, and they're okay. But not me, you know? Not me. I'm different. I'm an addict. I, unlike them, am powerless over lust. I cannot control and enjoy it. It ends up controlling me, and it makes me mishiga. And I hate myself, you know. The one time I'm the most miserable is when I'm lusting. That I know. So if I feel miserable, I immediately think, am I lusting? It goes the other way around, too. So, you know, you got a problem with staying sober? The problem isn't in your step three or your step four. The problem is in your step one. You know?
So?
Now, just one more thing. Now, if you're sober for a while, if you're already sober for a while, you're sober for, you know, a few months, and you're working the steps, and you're having a big problem staying sober after a few months, so then it's possible that your problem is that you're not working step four. You know what I'm saying? And since you're not working step four, in other words, you have resentments that are not being dealt with and things that are driving you crazy in life. In other words, sobriety is driving you crazy. Life without alcohol, without lust, without porn and schmutz and acting out is driving you crazy. You can't stand it, and you end up wanting to drink again, to act out again. So in other words, yeah, of course, a person who's up to step four is not working his fourth step, he's screwed because he's going to end up drinking again because life is too uncomfortable. You know, but for a person who hasn't had any significant period of sobriety yet, the issue isn't step four. Even though, yes, life is making him very uncomfortable, and it's impossible for him to stay sober in the long term because he doesn't have a step four, five, six, seven yet. But that's not the immediate issue. The immediate issue is he's just not ready to be sober at all because he doesn't have a step one yet. Thank you for being patient and waiting for me to finish that thought. Whoever you are. Who are you?
So, this is Oval.
Oh, hi, Oval.
Can I ask a simple question, please?
Yeah, sure.
So in other words, the sanity that we're talking about in step two is for the acting and the thinking, right? Those two issues. The acting insanely and the thinking insanely.
I don't know what else there is. Feeling? You mean feeling? I'm not sure what else there is.
Well, feeling, in my opinion, feeling could be a lot of having to work maybe on trauma or other issues, but there are other issues. You know.
Okay, yeah. So that sounds like what it is, yeah. When a person lets go of a resentment, how do you know if you've let go of a resentment in step six and seven? How do you know if you've really let go of your resentment? And God's
he explains it. Thomas Chaim explains the answer to that.
Okay,
if the guy would walk in the room and you're not all bent out of shape, you're okay with it.
Okay.
If he comes to the room.
Okay. All right. But I mean, Chuck talks about it a little bit simpler. He just says you don't have it anymore. That's all. And that's what the books are talking about. It's obvious in the words. If I give it up, then I still have it. But if I give it up and God takes it away, six and seven, then I don't have it anymore. Does it mean that I can't take it back? No, of course you can take it back. You can take back a resentment. You can take back your pride. If God removes my pride, he doesn't remove resentment. He removes my character defect. If he removes my character defect and I don't have that pride anymore and I feel my resentment to this guy dissolve, just disappear, because I don't have that pride that's driving my resentment, then God has removed my pride. And that's why I don't have this resentment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't remove resentment. So
mm-hmm.
so now if the next day comes and the guy does something and I feel angry at him the same way and I feel like telling him off or something, then obviously, what's happened? I've taken back my pride. That's what's come back. Not my resentment. My pride has come back because I've been living with my pride for 35 years, 45 mm-hmm. years. How do you expect it to just go away completely? When the situation comes, I will take that pride out of the file and I will reproduce it because that's how I react to these situations. And I will try to find pride. I need pride quick because this guy's doing something that I find threatening and I'm going to take out my pride quick, you know? And that's called taking back a character defect, I think. But you know what? You're getting very lemaisa here, and that's beautiful. We don't have any more time. Oh, it's ready after one. I apologize. But step four, I'm going to talk about more, God willing, next time. We're going to go through 4, 5, 6, 7 and, on the Wednesday call, God willing. The way I look at step 4, I was in the program for a few years before I really went through step 4 in any real fashion. I mean, I did like a rudimentary step 4 around a year and a half, and that's when my wife started finding it more comfortable to live with me, and we started having very few fights. We got into a fight every night I went to a meeting. Every night I went to a meeting, we got into a fight for like a year and a half. And then it started, and then it stopped. And I didn't even notice that it stopped. Like all things in the program, these things creep up on us. We don't notice that they stopped. We don't notice that we've changed until a while after. It kind of bites us in the back, you know? And you go, whoa, this hasn't happened in 6 months. I wonder when that went away. Hey, Velgo, can you just mute your phone, my friend? Because
sure.
The recording, I'm afraid. Thank you very much. It might be background noise, and it could. Thank you. Thank you very much, Chava. So you know, unless you may have something else you want to say, so go ahead and unmute. But you know, well, you're not. So thank you. So anyway, what was I talking about? I'm sorry. So I couldn't work step four in a satisfying way, though, for quite a while because I didn't really understand what the big book meant. The big book uses it, and it boiled down to one term, affects my. I had no idea what that means, and I still don't know what that means. Affects my pride, affects my, I don't understand. That terminology doesn't make any sense to me. It never made any sense to me then. And people kept reading me the big book thing. I knew the people with the Hazelden 16-page, you know, checklist. Check, 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 check. Do you have this anger? Yes, check. That's useless to me. I knew from my first step exercise when I wrote out my story what a big difference it meant when I emotionally, psychologically, and everything, when I wrote it down on paper. And as we do an essay, and this is not an essay call, I'm just an essay guy sharing this. What we do in essay that everywhere I know essay is share your first step after you've written it down with your group. Public sharing of your first step story, you know, with safe people. You know, some people only share it with their sponsor, I've heard, but I've never seen that. In my home group, we don't do that. We generally share it with the group. There's no rule that you have to. Because it's, again, it's not a religion. It's all suggestions. This book is meant to be suggestive only. That's what it says in AA. That's all. So we realize we know only a little. You know, that's what it says in AA. This book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. Those are the words. So, and that's the way it works. It's not a religion. You know, and so you know, and it's the same thing worked for me in the fourth step. When I wrote it, I knew I couldn't do like a checklist with like checking off these different things, filling in the boxes with like a word, yes, no, this, that, would be a complete waste of time for me in the long term. I don't want to be thrown a bone like a dog at the dinner. I want the steak. My sponsor would say that to me all the time. You want the steak, or you just want to just have a bone there, and that's it. Do you want the steak dinner, you know, the whole thing, or you just want a good taste? You want to have a taste of the step, do a checklist, you know? The real step is by writing it out in your own handwriting, putting it outside yourself, and then sharing it with somebody else. That's why there's a step five. Shared the entire, what's the lesson of step five? I'm just drawing a blank. We
admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our role.
Yeah. So thank you. We admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. I personally would switch the order because I don't think that I'm going to admit it to God until I first admitted it really to myself. And I don't think I'm going to really admit it to myself until I'm going to admit it to another human being. I know that's the way I work. And I know that's the way everybody that I've met so far works. Because we're alone with God when we're doing what? When we're masturbating ourselves. Oh, yeah, that honesty with God is really, really real, isn't it? You know? It's not. You know? No. Between me and my God, b'mis tarim tivke nafshi. Yeah. I don't think so. B'mis tarim tivke nafshi and masturbated a lot. And looked at porn, and snuck this, and snuck that. That's what happens by Ms. Turin. Between me and God, no. Nope. There's something missing in that relationship, obviously. Because if it were really there, I wouldn't be doing these things with him watching me. Nope. Wouldn't be doing these things. I obviously have a problem. There's something missing here. You know? and it's not about Hashem, and it's not going to come to me from learning Sfarim about Hashem and this and that. There's something wrong with me, not with him, with me. It's nothing to do with Yiddishkeit. There's something wrong with me. So I need to be honest with another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. This is where it says in the steps, exact nature of our wrongs. In other words, we don't say, I stole. If that's in your fourth step, I stole, you lost it. That's not the exact nature of our wrongs. What Bill is suggesting here is that we share the exact nature of our wrongs explicitly and clearly with another human being, safe human being. You know? So I know I need to write out in longhand a fourth step. That's clear to me. That's what works. That's clear to me that that's what works, you know, for me. So therefore, my fourth step was written out. I wrote out, like Bill suggests in the big book, the four columns, straight and simple. But I couldn't understand the exact way the four columns were in the big book, so I suffered with them for years. I was at a Sexaholics Anonymous international convention in around 1999 or something like that, and I sat down with some stranger there, you know, and he said, I'll help you do the fourth, don't worry, you know. And we worked through fourth step a little bit on a big legal pad, and I just kept getting stuck on that third column, fourth column. It affects my, what does that mean, you know? Until finally, I for myself, I just, you know, developed a simple way to do it, that after I did it, I showed it to my sponsor, and he said, yeah, that's what I've been telling you all along, you know? I just couldn't understand what he was saying. So we're going to talk about that next time when we talk about the fourth step. But for the benefit of people who aren't going to hear the next talk, I'm just going to review it very, very simply and clearly right now. And maybe that'll be the end of me on this call for today. One, my complaints. One at a time. One complaint at a time. My complaints about my life. My complaints. It could be things that people did to me. It could be things that are circumstances in my life that I may see them as God's fault. I may see them as other people's fault. I may see them as my fault, you know. But there are circumstances in my life, you know. Another version of these complaints could be things that I did that I am ashamed of, you know. I did this and I'm ashamed of it. There are things that I wrote down in my fourth step list and shared with my sponsor that I never thought I would ever tell any soul on this planet. Things that I did that I was so ashamed of, and some of them weren't even so bad, but I was just so incredibly ashamed of them because they were just embarrassing, you know? And I wrote them all down in that first column, you know? And hiding these things and carrying them around is a big mistake. So that's the first column. Simple. Second column, for me, second column is, I'm saying, not simple for me, I'm saying that these are the columns for me. This is how I'm suggesting trying the fourth step. The second column is explaining the exact details of the first column. In other words, I'll do this all next time too. In other words, this is my complaint, this is my gripe, this is my embarrassing thing, whatever it is. This is what happened, or this is the circumstance in my life that I am poor, you know, that I have a disease, whether it's sexaholism or whether it's asthma or whether it's hay fever or whether it's cancer or whether it's broken something or whether it's, you know, being fat or being this or being that, whatever it is, you know, that's my complaint. This is bothering me. If it's bothering me, I write it down, you know. This is my complaint. The second column is exactly what is bothering me about it. Well, when people walk into the room and they see me, I feel like they look down on me because I have no money and everyone knows. You know? So that would be column two. Okay? Column two. Second column. When the guy drives around, you know, people cut me off. That's my first column. This guy cut me off in traffic. It drives me crazy. And my second column would be, when he's driving away, I feel like he's, you know, I see him smile, and that makes me want to strangle him, you know. And so that's the ichor of my first column. That's when it really hits me. That's the Shiloh. That's what the second column is about. The first column is in general. The second column is, let's get really specific now about exactly what it is that's bothering me so deeply about this situation. Column three is, what do I feel like doing as a result of that situation? The guy drives by, and he like honks his horn as he drives by. That's when I feel like I want to strangle this guy. Oh, strangle the guy? Okay, so that's what I want to do. That's pretty clear. Let me be clear. That's exactly what I want to do. I want to resort to violence, you know, or I want to crawl under a floorboard. I'm so embarrassed. Such a thing happens. I was in shul and I made a mistake in laning, and I felt like, you know, everyone corrected me, and I felt like I wanted to die. You know, I felt like I wanted to hide. And I felt like I wanted to walk off the bima and walk away. You know, well, that could be violence too. Because, you know, I'm doing something that I'm hurting everyone as a result. Look what you did to me. You know, or it could be shame. I'm just trying to run away. I want to run away. You know, that's what I want to do. I want to run and hide. So that's the third column. The fourth column is, what does it say about a person? You take it away from yourself. Use a straw man, like Rabbi Nochum Weinberg used to talk about. Use a straw man. Imagine a person in such a situation, what does it say about this person that he reacts this way? A person of column one and two, what does it say about him that he wants to react the way I described clearly in column three, bottom, okay? And that's basically it. You know, that's all you get from the fourth step. The fourth step isn't a solution to any problems. It doesn't do anything to you except self-acceptance, which is huge, but it doesn't solve any problem. So we're off the mute now. I'm done with the segment. And it's open up to questions if anybody has anything they want to say. And I'm going in 2 minutes. So just register a question or share something if you want. If you've shared before, please leave room for other people now. I'm going to cut the recording off in about a minute. If anybody wants to share anything that's going to be on the recorder, that's fine. Something they want to share about any of the discussion, it's okay. And otherwise, we'll just stop it here.
I think you might still have a mute on.
Oh. Yeah. No, I unmuted. Let me try that again. Yeah. Nope. Okay, well, it's unmuted now. Okay, whatever. So I'm going to stop the recording here. Hang on a minute.